LLP versus Assam. Mr. Domina, good morning to you. Let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Fred Assam, who was a partner in a law firm that seeks to recover the value of his partnership interest. The parties have a disagreement about the standard of review, and I want to focus on that first by focusing you on the nature of the claims that are presented here. Initially, the partnership sued Mr. Assam claiming he committed fraud. They amended their complaint to add claims of breach of contract. On the morning of trial, as the Bill of Exceptions reflects on pages 18 and 19, it was announced in court that the claims of breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty would not be proven. There would be nothing offered on that. And this exchange occurred. Counsel for I noted that I expected no proof on those. The court asked counsel for the law firm, are you going to try to prove your claims? And the response was, it was correct that they would not do so. And the colloquy continued. To be clear, our position is that we, I guess, would like to reinstate, perhaps better state it, the original complaint that included a declaratory action for this court to make a declaration regarding the fair market value as provided in the contract. That would be what we would be proceeding under.
Who was speaking?
That was the law firm's lawyer, Your Honor, who was speaking. The court then asked for a comment from Mr. Assam's lawyer about whether there was an objection to amending the pleadings at that time or amending to conform with the proof at the end of the trial, and this was the response which I made for Mr. Assam. I obviously have no objection to dropping all of those other theories out. I think that if we proceed with the announced intention that the sole relief sought here is that relief, referring to the comments of counsel, that's a representation made on the record. If counsel thinks it would be helped by filing an actual pleading that says that to you, I don't object. If they do that prior to the time of their rest or amend to conform at the time of their rest, and we can proceed with trial on the basis just announced. We proceeded with trial. And at trial, the only issue tried was what was the value of the withdrawing partner in the partnership. This court has held previously that that issue is an issue in equity. You have a specific case reaching that holding that the parties did not cite in our briefs, DARR, D-A-R-R versus D-R-S, which is cited at, which is 232 Nebraska 507, 232-507, a 1989 case. You have a decision from earlier this year, the O'Connor versus Kearney Junction case, in which you held that how the parties characterize a pleading is not determinative. It's the substance of the case that is both pled and presented that is determinative of what it is that is actually tried and of the nature of the proceeding. Our position is that the action below was absolutely and unconditionally one in equity to determine the value of a partner's interest. That makes your standard of review a de novo standard. And that's what we're here for, de novo review. Now getting to the merits, Mr. Assam owned 23.25% of the equity in a five-partner partnership. One partner owned 7%. The parties proceeded to trial on the basis that all of the assets had to be valued. That's consistent both with the law of the District of Columbia, which we think controls, and your jurisprudence as well. But when the case was decided, two assets were completely left out of the decision by the trial court. Here's the simplest one. The partnership owns a 74% interest in a building in Colorado. It was left out by the trial court. And the second one is that Mr. Assam voluntarily withdrew from his partnership on October 2. His voluntary withdrawal was accepted. And on October 3, his partners purport to have charged off their books $10.2 million of accounts receivable on active accounts upon which the lawyers in the law firm were continuing to provide service. This is a law firm with a specialized practice. Almost entirely, its practice is for Indian tribes across the United States. The undisputed evidence is that the accounts receivable routinely have a very long tail because they are routinely either funded by funds advanced by the BIA to the Indian tribes and managed in trust for them, or for some other reason controlled by federal government processes that cause delay. We had an example that was specifically pointed out at trial of an account receivable that was 8 years old and a near seven-figure amount collected after 8 years from a tribe called the Gun Lake Tribe, I think in Wisconsin as I recall. There was no dispute about those facts. When Mr. Assam went to Exhibits 34 and 35 and systematically looked at the charged-off accounts using the law firm's record, using the law firm's data, he could point out where within the last 90 days work was done on those accounts, the amount and value of that work, the growth in those receivables. He identified $600,000 out of the $10.2 million that had not had active work for more than 90 days. The rest was within that time period.
What did the other experts say about the uncollected accounts receivables?
Your Honor, there is a dispute in the experts about what the discount on accounts receivable should be. But there isn't any dispute about the expert opinions concerning whether they should be charged off or not. That point, should they be charged off or not, was simply unconditionally accepted as fact by the law firm's expert. It wasn't his opinion. He just concluded they charged it off. My expert said, no, wait a minute. Those receivables can't be charged off, and historically the charge-off rate that was given in the testimony was 70%. And our calculation from our expert was that the recovery history was 57% actually lower. So our expert valued the active accounts and applied the discount that we found from the data of the law firm.
Counsel, who called Flanagan and Fullerton as their experts?
My side did, Your Honor.
Didn't they agree that 9 of the $10 million was uncollectible?
Well, no, they did not. They agreed that 9 of the $10 million had been identified as uncollectible and was different from $1.2 million. And they only acknowledged that the firm had said it was uncollectible, and when asked, do you have affirmative evidence of its collectability, their answer was no. And that answer was given before Mr. Assam testified. So they did not have the benefit of Mr. Assam going through the receivables and showing the court, as is so easy to see from them, that they were active accounts.
It was, I beg your pardon, do I understand that you're saying they did not make an opinion of being uncollectible? They were saying they don't have the basis to render an opinion, the law firm claims it to be uncollectible. That's
correct. And so therefore they didn't conduct an independent investigation of collectability. We're asking you to reverse on trial de novo and give Mr. Assam his share of the receivable. One other thing I'll mention. No, I won't. I'll save it for a moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brislam, good morning to you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Brian Brislin. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Fredericks, Peoples, and Morgan Law Firm. As Mr. Domina identified, the threshold issue here, I think, for the Court to consider is what standard of review will be applied to this matter. I disagree with the characterization of the underlying case as being one in equity. It is a law question. The case was tried without objection, and evidence was produced by all parties as to what the value of the withdrawing partner's interest is in the assets of the partnership.
How was that determined?
I'm sorry?
How was that determined?
The partnership contract unambiguously sets forth that the parties to that contract agreed that a dissociating partner will be entitled to 100% of the fair market value, a term of art. These are lawyers entering into this contract saying that the fair market value is what will be paid out to the dissociating partner.
So is this a contract interpretation?
It is not. There's no interpretation of the underlying contract necessary. The contract unambiguously is agreed to by both parties. States what the standard is. It's only an application of what's the fact.
Well, it's not as easy as a liquidated amount.
It's not.
So then, right, so that is, in undertaking to establish that, is it a question of law, of the amount, is that a question of law?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe it's a question of fact. So the question of fact being, what would a willing buyer and a willing seller, under the compulsion to buy or sell, transact for this interest in this partnership? That's what these parties agreed to. And that's a factual determination that the court made, heard from, really say four different experts on this, five, if you count the I. Bailey folks, because I think they have two of them on the report. They looked at all of the evidence, it made those factual analyses, and determined which opinion it found to be most credible.
Let's just adopt your formula. Willing buyer and willing seller on what date?
It would be the value as of the date of the dissociation withdrawal. So that would be, in this case, the...
Not the notice of the appellant.
I believe the notice came on October 2nd. It was accepted October 3rd, formally accepted by the partnership at the partnership meeting. And that raises a good sort of time-space issue here.
Right.
Is how
right.
This works.
When the write-off happened.
The write-off that Mr. Assam is complaining about was set for the agenda. This is something that had been discussed by the partners, including Mr. Assam, and set on the agenda that was to occur at the meeting,
But that's the answer to a different question. When did it happen?
Well, it functionally happened after Mr. Assam sent the email. It was placed on the agenda for
Thank you.
Mr. Assam was fully aware that this was an issue that the partnership was going to decide.
Counsel, your opponent characterizes the action that was tried as the valuation of a partnership. What's your characterization of it? I know you're saying it's a law, but I'm still waiting to hear what you're characterized breach of contract. Is that what you're claiming it is, or is it something else?
No, Your Honor. It is the determination of fair market value of Mr. Assam's 23.5% of the partnership.
And isn't that part of the dissolution of the partnership?
There is no dissolution. And this is an important point.
Is this an accounting?
There was an accounting asked for, and the accounting was given. There was no evidence of that the accounting was not given presented by Mr. Assam at trial in support of his counterclaim. The evidence is full that Mr. Assam's experts had all of the accounting information that he prayed for in his complaint. There was no dispute about the accounting issue.
So this is a disassociation?
A disassociation of a partner from a partnership.
A dissolution of a partnership.
Correct.
And what's the difference?
Yeah. Does that make a difference?
It does. And it makes the most difference in the standard of review. The standard of review cases cited by Mr. Assam in his briefing and here today deal with even DARR case versus DRS that Mr. Domina referenced in his initial argument. That references a dissolution of a partnership case. Okay? And the court has characterized those in its prior rulings as de novo review cases where you're dissolving or interpreting whether there is a dissolution. That can happen because of either contractual partnership reasons or by statute for reasons that the legislature has set forth for us that could cause a dissolution of the partnership. That is not an issue in this case. This is a simple issue of parties to a partnership contract being governed by the unambiguous terms of that contract. One of them was Mr. Assam, who elected, as he had the right under the contract, to dissociate himself from the partnership, to say, I no longer want to be a partner in this. That he had that right under the contract, there's no question about that. There's no interpretation for this court or the court below to undertake about that.
There's no statute or uniform statute applicable to disassociation, is that?
There is, the statute would only apply, Your Honor, in the case where the partnership agreement did not cover the issue. So the Partnership Act in Nebraska and most other states says your partnership agreement, what the parties agree to, governs. Unless it's silent or ambiguous, then you can go look at the statute.
So if it was to enforce a contract, was there a right to a jury?
I believe there was a right to a jury.
Nobody requested a jury.
No one requested a jury. It was tried to the bench by consent of both parties. Both parties had a right to convene a jury if they asked for one and have the jury determine, as a factual matter, what is this value? And what does the jury do? It takes the facts that is presented by all of the parties. It weighs those facts. It looks at the witnesses testify. It weighs their credibility in their mind. The testimony affects that credibility, including Mr. Hassan. Testifying that his opinion is you shouldn't follow his to retain experts' opinions.
Let me back up to the to what the good witch says in Wizard of Oz. It's best to start at the beginning.
Sure.
What is the form of action? Declaratory judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then within that, there's jurisprudence. You got to look at what's going on to figure out what pigeonhole you go to next. Is that a fair generalization?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Where'd you go?
We went to the simple issue, the fact issue.
Did you go into, is there a form of action that is most like this?
Well, what the form of action really was to help the parties take a term that has a defined methodology or metric to it, and say what is the math that comes out after you apply that metric. The metric being what would a willing buyer, willing seller, both apprised of the of all material facts, neither under the compulsion to buy or sell, what would that person pay for Mr. Assam's interest? And what's important about that standard is, and this is why the court in its order mentions these things, that Mr. Assam, in his own opinion and in the opinion he asked for from his experts, wanted to read the term market out of that analysis. He wanted to create an ambiguity in the contract where none existed. The court below and neither party outwardly claimed that there was an ambiguity here, but the standard that Mr. Assam applied in his own mind and on the stand, and that he, at Exhibit 81, asked his experts at Ide Bailey to apply, is to read the word market out. And his argument about that was that the contract itself created a market. It created a requirement the partnership buy, and therefore there is a market, and therefore you have to read market out of the plain terms of the contract.
So what was the market, in your view?
Well, the market is a determination of the pool of lawyers that would want to practice Indian law with these group of people. What would that person go in and buy into this partnership?
Were there discounts given for marketability by the experts?
Yes, Your Honor.
All of them?
Not Mr. Assam.
The only
if you want to count Mr. Assam as an expert on that issue, he did not apply any discounts.
Everyone else did?
Everyone else did. The amount of the discount is what is complained of, because, of course, the expert who was ultimately adopted, Mr. Brennan, applied a larger discount in a variety of ways than the experts retained by Mr. Assam. Now, Mr. Assam presented essentially three gradually lower valuations of the partnership. The one found of those three most credible by the court below was Mr. Stadler's opinion, and Mr. Stadler admitted several times that Mr. Brennan was more of an expert on valuing law firms than he was, that he had overinflated his own, Mr. Stadler's own, opinion by $600,000 and had some other key admissions that the court found as a factual matter made her rely upon Mr. Brennan's report. There are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor, and we ask the court affirm Judge Stratman's order in full.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal?
1 minute and 44 seconds.
Mr. Domina.
May it please the court, I'd like to spend a minute talking about the distinction between those cases that we try to a jury to determine value and those cases that are tried in equity to determine value. This is by observation. I can't find a court that has said this specifically. But a review of the cases suggests that when the transaction is one that involves disinterested persons making an acquisition, as in a condemnation proceeding, or as in a dispute over a contract for a sale between generally disinterested persons, that's an issue of law tried to a jury. But when the transaction...
Issue of fact tried to a jury?
It's an issue of fact in a proceeding at law tried to a jury. Pardon me.
Thank you.
That's correct. But when it's an internal matter involving persons in a relationship that has fiduciary aspects, particularly partnership relationships, you have historically called those equitable proceedings. And the rationale for that may well be that the market is different. The marketability concept is entirely different. And the partners are able to consider that at the time they enter into their contract about how one will get out. Under the law firm's view in this case, if you assume for a minute that the partnership has no assets except the charged off accounts receivable of $10.2 million, the judgment below is less than 5% of Mr. Assam's interest in that pool. And he had no way to reach it to express an interest in his a value for his interest in it except his expert. The outcome here is absurd if it stands.
Thank you very much. The next case.